Okay, folks, welcome back to another episode of the Brand Builder Show. And in today's episode, we're going to do a deep dive brand story with a brand owner who's going to be talking us through how he's grown this brand over the last couple of years. Really exciting growth we're seeing and really excited to talk it through. Kelly, thanks for joining us on the show today.
Thanks for having me, Ben. Let's do it.
My pleasure. What are you drinking there? You got a bit of coffee there or?
A little coffee. It's early in the day, although I drink coffee all the way through the day if you let me.
Yeah. Same, yeah. What's your coffee of choice?
We actually drink a lot of coffee here. So at the company, you know, I believe in keeping them caffeinated, Ben. Latte, latte, latte. You know, get them to push right through the day. We're drinking a coffee out of Philadelphia. I'm in the U.S. and it's called Collectivo. It's called La Colombe Coffee.
Okay.
And it's an interesting story, actually, talking about building a brand. Husband and wife started it in the city of Philadelphia, and they had it for many, many years, and it was purchased by the famous founder of the yogurt company called Chobani Yogurt, which is an amazing U.S. success story. If you've ever heard of that brand, a Greek immigrant came here, started making Greek yogurt and went crazy bonkers. He's multi-billionaire or multi-billion dollar company. So really amazing story.
Nice. Well, I could talk about coffee all day as well as drink it. So we'll move on for the sake of getting distracted, because I could definitely do another cup right now. But thanks so much for coming on the show. I'm excited to talk through your journey. I've been reading up a little bit about it, but didn't want to find out everything because I want to try and keep it for the episode. But an exciting journey you've been on. Why don't you catch our audience up with who you are, the brand, and what the journey has been like up until this point. A bit of backstory before the brand as well would be amazing.
Yeah. Well, that's left the door wide open for me. I'll try to do it quickly.
I'll see you in half an hour. Yeah.
You know, I'm kind of in a later stage in my career. A lot of entrepreneurs, I think it's being an entrepreneur is somewhat of a youth sport. Talking about sports earlier, it's more of a youth sport than it is an older guy sport. And I think that's because of risk profiles. You know, when you're earlier on in your career and you have less responsibility, usually family, I'm speaking of, type of responsibilities, you can take more risk. But this is my third company that I've owned. I started a company in high school and college. It was a painting company. I lived in New England in the U.S., so there was a lot of house painting required. Probably seen pictures of New England, clapboard houses. Nothing like what you've got age-wise where you're from, but did a lot of painting, had a bunch of people that worked on my painting crew. And then I went into an 18, 19-year career in corporate America. And then I came out of that in 2009 and created a global in-store design and strategy company. So I was working for 18 years in merchandising. So I was creating packaging and merchandising for consumer products. So they're the golf ball sleeves or the cigarette boxes or the perfume boxes, and then the actual in-store physical display, whether it's a temporary display or signage or permanent fixturing displays. That's what I was doing. My corporate job, my agency was focused on design research and strategy. So understanding how people are actually going to be perceiving a product at a retail shelf and what would be more or less incentivizing of them to buy it. So colors, shapes, words, messaging, just the retail experience. I did that for 10 years, including having an office in London and a team there. And a team in Asia, grew that to a multi-million dollar business. And then out of that came Tiege Hanley, founded it in 15, launched it, failed, refounded it in 16 or restarted it in 16. And the business has grown to significant revenue. We're kind of in that 20 million range since we founded it 7 years ago now. It's amazing. Short overview on the journey.
Yeah, yeah, that's amazing. I mean, there's so much to dive into there.
Yeah.
The thing that really obviously first stands out is that beginning, 2015. Started it, failed, started it again. What happened there?
Well, you know, a lot of things were going wrong, you know, with our business. So just so you know, we're in the men's skincare space. Mm-hmm. Our mission is to help men look and feel amazing. Kind of our unique selling proposition is to get guys to think about healthy skincare routines. So washing your face and putting a moisturizer on, base of the routine. And then we're a subscription business. So we ship you these routines on a regular basis, month over month. We allow you to kind of customize your routine, take products out, add products, or if you want, just buy whenever you want as an individual purchase. So that's our business model. The reason why we weren't successful with the launch is most of those components I just described were there at launch, routine. We didn't have a subscription component. It was just kind of a one-time purchase.
Yeah.
And we didn't really technically had a brand. It was Tiege Hanley, and it was at Tiege.com, but we were selling other people's products. And, okay. You know, it's selling other people's products is kind of a very difficult thing because there's something out there called Amazon, and it's almost impossible to compete. You know, if I'm selling a product and everybody else is selling that same product on Amazon, there's nothing unique about our product. We were just trying to educate guys on healthy skincare routines. Selling other people's products in our box didn't really work.
Yeah. And so what convinced you to go back in with a fresh approach?
Well, the other thing, and I shouldn't have left this out. The other thing is we had no voice. So what I mean by that is, you know, trying to just get out, right, as a brand, especially selling a product and being out in the world, is very, 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 very difficult, unless you have a way to broadly connect to consumers. Mm. So when I say we didn't have a voice, we didn't really have a very clear way of connecting to consumers in a large scale. So we were attempting to work with an influencer that was in the male grooming space to help us with a voice. He had already established a voice in the grooming space and talking about what it means to be a guy and taking care of yourself. So we reached out to connect to him to help us with this version one that I just described. And he said, I'd really be interested in helping you, but it needs to be your own, like, your own brand, and it needs to be a subscription. And if you do that, I'd like to partner with you. Instead of taking your money, I'd like to be your partner. So it was like a trifecta of luck. Actually, we also met a chemist at that exact same time within 3 weeks apart. So it was like and we knew nothing about the skincare chemistry side of the business. Mm-hmm. So it was like a trifecta of luck, you know, reaching out to someone to help us create a voice in the market, having him being interested in being a partner in the business, and then coming up with, you know, the requirement of building our own brand and creating a subscription business. So all those things kind of came together over 60 days.
Yeah. Wow. That's a lot of stars aligning there. That's amazing how it all kind of came together. It's interesting because I think, you know, that model is very much prevalent today. You know, you see it in the, you know, celebrity brand era, the celebrities that are the faces of brands, but you know they're not really the brains behind the operations running it in the back end. You know, there's people like Ezra Firestone has done that with Boom by Cindy Joseph. You see it a lot now, but back, what, seven, eight years ago, that wasn't really a prominent strategy. Were you nervous about giving over equity, having him come on board as a partner? Was there a part you wanted him just to, no, take the money and stay on the outside? How was that for you?
Yeah, well, firstly, I think what your comment, Ben, is really very true. Today you see it a lot. I think there's a question in my mind as a consumer about the authenticity of, you know, is that celebrity really trying to solve a problem for consumers, you know, or are they just trying to capitalize on, you know, the fact that they're a celebrity? 7 years ago, I think it was a different situation. Aaron Marino, who's one of my two partners, Rob Hoxie's the other, college roommate of mine. But Aaron, who was a YouTuber, he was truly interested in the skincare space. I mean, that was like really something that he was very, engaged with. And he really, he really did want to help solve a problem for him as an individual and for, you know, and for the millions of people that listen to him on a regular basis. So I think he was really, really engaged with the idea and really, really wanted to do it. As a matter of fact, when we first spoke to him, it was with his agent, and it was mind-numbing to me. This is in 2015, in the fall of 15, that a YouTuber would actually have an agent. Like, you know, it's just really... but Aaron, in the original call was about Aaron pitching our V1 business. It was him saying, you guys are doing this wrong. We need to think about building a brand and the things I just mentioned, and I'll be your partner. That was really kind of the pivot for us. But to answer your question, I think this is a ferociously good question, which is giving over equity to somebody, you know, like an influencer, and is that a scary proposition? So there's two ways to look at it, and I have the beauty of the experience, and I didn't understand this then, is that you could try to get somebody to invest in your business as a brand. So typical VC in investing, right? So you go out and you pitch your idea and you tell a bunch of people why you think it's a great idea and why you're uniquely capable of fulfilling this idea, and hope that they're going to give you money. Now, if you do that, then you've got, you know, a bank full of money, possibly, and you've got no sales, so you have no voice, right? And then you say, okay, well, I'm going to go figure out how to hire somebody to get a voice. What I did was I gave a bunch of equity to somebody who was really interested in the business in return for having a voice. So with the equity that I gave to him, I got the voice. So I think if you have a choice, would you rather have money in the bank, or would you rather have a voice that's going to bring you sales immediately?
Yeah.
And, you know, so in hindsight, I think I basically got the sales immediately for the next several years by giving Aaron equity, because he brought that voice to us, and he brought that authenticity to us that we really needed, and he reached millions of guys for many years for us. So it was the right thing for us by a long shot. I'd much rather have the voice than the money.
For sure. Yeah, and I think it's the right thing for a lot of people. I think it's a strategy that in 2023 and moving forwards, audience is everything, right? And attention, being able to get the attention of consumers is everything. You've mentioned this concept quite a few times about the voice that you have, which I'd love to come back on, but I want to try and go through it a bit more sort of chronological. So before we get there and marketing and first sales and everything, I'd love just to ask a little bit about product development, because you talked about the chemistry, and obviously a supplement product, a skincare product especially, is going to be chemistry involved in that. We don't have to get into the kind of the super detailed version of it, but there must have been some challenges for you. What was that journey of ideation? Did you know we want to sell this product? Was it a hero product you started with? And what was that initial product development phase like? I know, broad question, but just give us a bit of insight there.
Yeah, there's an interesting book called How to Think Like a Rocket Scientist, and I'm trying to think of the author. I believe it's Pavlov.
It's quite a unique title.
So it's a phenomenal book. I really suggest it to a lot of your audience. He talks about this kind of ability to be a disruptor based on not having certain set of knowledge, right? That there's an advantage to somebody who has never looked at solving a problem before versus people that have been trying to solve that problem for a long time. And we knew nothing, myself, Rob, and Aaron, who I just mentioned, we knew nothing of product development or chemistry. I mean, we really knew nothing. We got super lucky because, I mean, incredibly lucky because we found somebody who had been in cosmetic chemistry his entire career. And we really just kind of bullshit our way through it and told him that we wanted, we gave him some benchmarks of products that we thought were excellent. And we gave him some criteria of what we think a male customer is looking for. But then we just said, bring us the best products that you can. And then when we started, there's two ways to develop products. There's really only one way, in my opinion, but there's two ways that consumer product companies like, and talking about beauty and skincare, you could go to like a contract manufacturer, there's someone that manufactures specific products like body wash or deodorant or skincare, and ask them to develop a product for you. And typically a lot of them have like bases of products developed, and then they add, they sprinkle a wand or some foo-foo dust over it, and they go, here you go, Ben, here's your product. And they put a label on it, and it says like Ben Skincare, and you're off and running. There's a lot of companies that take that approach. There's really nothing that unique about that individual product. And then there's also a really big challenge with it, which is you're somewhat beholden, not somewhat, you're completely beholden to that manufacturer because they have the technology and the chemistry around that product. So, you know, they have complete control, pricing control over you, et cetera, et cetera. The way we did it was we, as I was describing to you, we have a chemist, and we did give him a few percentages points in the business early on. As a matter of fact, he's made out tremendously. And we were able to take that formulas that we developed for all our core products, and we ended up going to different contract manufacturers, making sure that they were all capable of producing it, and then giving us a price and going with the company that we felt was best suited to manufacture our product. So it gives us a competitive advantage and control over our COGS. And so our products happen to be, when our contract manufacturers were bidding on it originally, they were shocked. They were like, you know, these ingredients are, you know, very hard to get. They're very expensive. The percentage of the active ingredients are very high. Are you sure you want to do this? And, you know, honestly, we had no idea. We're just like, absolutely, don't change a thing. Like, that's exactly what we want. And so we ended up making super good products that were very expensive relative to other products out on the market. But we had, you know, we had like control of our vendors, and we had control over our pricing. And since then, we've always developed all of our own products. So we'll, with internal and external, with our chemist, and we have a VP of product development, we'll spend, it takes us about a year to develop a product. So we'll spend about a year developing a product, and then it takes like another 6 months to get it to launch. And what we want to have is truly differentiated products that solve a problem, that can be part of a routine, that are extremely high quality. That's what we want. Because ultimately, and you know, Leonard Lauder from Estee Lauder, one of the most famous skincare cosmetic companies in the world, Estee Lauder said, you know, you can make any product, you can sell any product once, but to get people to come back and buy that product over and over again, it's got to be outstanding. So I think that's like the philosophy that we go for. We try to develop outstanding products.
Yeah, because that is the challenge, right, with consumables, with beauty, skincare, that kind of thing. There's a lot of people that will just put a new label on the same product and call it something different and try and suggest it's something different. But to actually differentiate, actually stand out, I was going to say it sounds like it takes a lot of work, and then you said it takes us a year to develop a product and 6 months to put it out. So that's no easy thing. Like, it's not just, oh, I'm going to sell a new product and have it on the shelves in 3 months. That's a significant commitment.
Yeah, I mean, if I can, if you don't mind me going, sticking with this, I wanted to give you two examples of our products versus the competitors' products and like and what we know. But in both of them, I'm going to take an example from women's beauty. There's a product called Glam Glow. It's a face mask. It comes in a tub. It's one of the best face masks available. It's a 2 ounce tub of product. It's a clay mask you put on your face, lanolin clay. And it sells for $85 for 2 ounces. We make our clay product is for men. It's very similar. It has a couple different ingredients, which we think is better for men. It's the same 2 ounce tub, made in the same factory, with all of the clay ingredients are identical. And we sell ours for $23, and they sell theirs for $85. I actually think, like, pure chemically speaking, our product is a better product than their product. So it's, you know, it comes down to the exact same product made in the same factory, one at $85, one at $23. I want to tell you a better story. Four weeks ago, we received a 11 pallet shipment of what we thought was our facial serum. We sell our facial serum for $27, one-time purchase, which is a very, very competitive price. We sell it for even less than that, around $20 for a subscription. That product, again, our formula developed by our chemist, manufactured from one of our contract manufacturers in the state of California. We received 11 pallets. It was not our facial serum. It was Gwyneth Paltrow's Goop facial serum. She hadn't launched it. She just launched it a few weeks ago. We open up the boxes and inspect them. Even though the exterior of the box says Goop, we want to make sure, like, we open up a box to make sure that it wasn't our product packed in her box, right? So we open up the product and it pull out, for sure it's her product. Take a look at the product, send it to our chemist to review. Made in the exact same factory. She's selling it for $150 for the exact same 0.5 ounce, the exact same factory. We have equal or better products. We sell ours for $27. She's selling hers for $150. The same almost box, the same almost packaging. So it's really bananas what you see out there. It's just, you know, her name is on it, so she's selling it for an exorbitant price.
That is crazy, really crazy. How do you feel then about wanting to, you talked about being a premium brand and having premium products. How do you feel if you are priced cheaper than the competition? Do you think that there are other ways you can create the feel of being a premium brand beyond just pricing?
Yeah, I think men's product pricing is different than women's products pricing. Okay. So I think, you know, for whatever reason it is, a woman feels like, you know, it's maybe that think like a rocket scientist thinking that all men have, I mean, the idea that we have to spend, you know, we're not going to get enough for our product for $25. We have to spend, you know, $150, and then we're going to get something really good. I don't think men think that way. No. So, you know, we're pretty at a premium price point, you know, although we're very, very, very affordable. I don't, like, to us, to reduce our prices really kind of cheapens our brand, in my opinion. So it's a balancing act between being, you know, moderately expensive and delivering high value. I mean, guys are going to come back over and over again because the product works. So we don't want to be too high price and not deliver. We have to be, you know, moderately high price and very good products.
Yep, definitely. When it comes to then getting that first product on sale, what was the strategy? Was it just 100% reliance on the partner that had the voice that came in? Was it just his audience that you were leveraging?
Yeah, it was. And he also, there's a lot of intangibles, right? Money in the bank versus a voice. We also got a lot of other intangibles with the voice, and that is that there was a lot of other people that were making content that looked up to Aaron, that wanted to make content for us too. So there was a halo effect around Aaron. And we started working with a lot of these other male grooming influencers that were talking about the things that Aaron was talking about. So we got that halo effect from Aaron, and all of our sales in year one and year two kind of came from him. The challenge came in about year four to year five, when we measure something called share of sight. We talk every day about, and basically it's attribution, channel attribution, acquisition attribution by channel on our site. Mm-hmm. And measuring kind of that media mix every day.
Yeah.
And so our share of site, you know, with my partner in the very early days was, 95% of our sales. Mm-hmm. And over time, his number continued to decrease. Mm-hmm. And at the same time, we needed to fill the sales that we were getting from him through other channels. Mm-hmm. And then grow on top of that. So it was like a really hard weaning off process. Mm-hmm. Of finding our ability to stand on our own. And today, the share of sight from that my particular partner's channel is very, very low, single digits, on a good week. And that I honestly is not to be thought of as being a negative. I mean, that's, he wanted desperately to allow to become, inconsequential in our sales, because otherwise, all the value is just on his channel, which isn't sustainable. So,
yeah, sure.
It just took us a long time to fill the void.
Mm. Yeah. It's a very healthy transition. As you say, you wouldn't want that to continue long-term, because you need there to be more diversification there. What are the main channels that have been successful for you?
It's still influencer. It's still long form.
Yep.
Influencer content.
Okay.
Works really well. And it's a very difficult channel. It's a very time consuming, labor intensive channel, unlike programmatic or any of the other channels. It's very, very labor intensive, but it's a very good channel for us.
Long form YouTube videos. That's what you mean by that?
Yeah, so long form, as opposed to short form content. Longer form is usually like anywhere from 10 minutes to 20 minute conversation about a specific topic. So it could be 20 minutes on why Rolex's watch is the best watch of all times based on the movement, or what you do on a first date, like 20 minutes on that or whatever. And so we're part of a conversation that's being had by a content producer over, a 15 or 10 to 20 minute segment typically.
Yeah. And the main thing would be like a paid ad in the middle.
A sponsored ad that's an integration into the topic. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay, cool. Very cool. You have talked about your sales prices, your costings. Obviously, you grew quite quickly at the start. What's the, in terms of the product economics and the quick growth, without being super premium priced, that would have put some tension on? What was the finance looking like in the first few years?
Well, I mean, early on, there was like money coming from every orifice of the company. There was cash coming in. It was a false kind of, it wasn't really an accurate experience to how life really is, right? Yeah. Because early on, you have a lot of sales, you have a little bit of overhead, you have your cost of goods sold kind of under control, and you have basically no money going to any marketing channels for the most part, right? Because it's all through somebody that you gave equity to. Mm-hmm. So there's cash everywhere. And you don't know what to do with it, and you really don't know how to deploy it, because you're really not truly good marketers at the early, mm-hmm. in the early days. So it was really, things were really easy in the early days. Mm-hmm. And it took us a couple of years to start developing a truly good company that we thought we would be around for years and years. So very painful transition.
Yeah, wow. That's definitely some challenges in there that we probably haven't got time to go into today. Some war stories, some scars there, but that's going to happen with the growth of any company, isn't there? Especially, you know, one that you are building a subscription model around. I'd love to understand the dynamics of that. Sure. Do you try and, with that first sale, still make profit, or are you very much along the... Because it's almost become a trend, I guess, as ads have got more expensive, to just want to break even on the front end and then pick up all of the profit on the back end, especially with subscriptions. Is that your framework, or are you
different? Yeah, that's exactly it. So, you know, you have to have extremely good data, and then you have to constantly, when I say constantly, I mean every day, pressure check your data to make sure that your assumptions of how much money you think you will make off of a specific customer. We go really deep into that. So not only do we look at a specific customer, but we look into the channels that they came in from, the offers that they came in from, the behaviors that they take, the age that they are, where they live, to predict what we think a future, and we don't rely, we use LTV, but we don't really, LTV is a backwards looking number, right? Yeah. It doesn't tell us, it told us what the value of a customer was over the previous period of time or lifetime, which is what, you know, the acronym stands for. And those assumptions change all the time. Like those behaviors and those customers change. Yeah. As you scale and grow and you work on different channels, it's not, having a single metric like that isn't good enough to run your business on. So we look at a future predicted 12-month value. And not a future predictive lifetime, but a future predicted 12 months, because we want to know exactly what we think is happening over with that customer over the next 12 months. And then we're projecting out a 12-month revenue, and then using and pressure checking that every day. And so we're predicting within 3% of, we're out over 6 months at 3% on what our reoccurring revenue in a margin of error of 3% of what our reoccurring revenue will be for that month. Yeah. So based on that, we can make assumptions on any day about how much money we want to spend to acquire a customer and how much beyond, you know, box one do we want to spend? Do we want to go to box two? Do we want to go to 1.7 boxes? Do we want to go to 2.2, 2.1, you know, 2.165? Like, where do we want to go? And it depends on all different types of things. It depends on how we're doing against our budget for the month, whether or not we can, you know, we can scale at a specific CAC, et cetera, et cetera. And our performance marketing team is making those decisions on a daily basis of where we want to spend and what channel and to what amount based on our projections and whether or not we're hitting them.
Yeah, I mean, it sounds like you're really crunching the numbers, obviously, as any good marketer really should do, especially at that scale. Do you find that the metrics will vary a lot from platform to platform, you know, average order value, et cetera?
Well, yeah, I mean, we use, you know, a lot of our own internal data. We don't use a lot of platform data. We do pull data from Meta and from Google, but a lot of the data that we're using is our own internal data. So I think the metrics, and people use different metrics too, you know, so it depends on, you know, and if you change those just a little bit, you'll have different outcomes. So yes, the answer to your question is they do vary a lot. So that's why we use our own internal calculations and estimations.
Yeah, definitely. Last sort of topic for me, just is the operational side of things. You mentioned a number of 20 million. Is that annually? Is that since you started?
Annually, we're at, like, you know, probably 80, 90 million since we started.
Amazing. So what does the business look like operationally now? You've talked a lot about checking this daily, checking that daily. It sounds full on. What is the team like? What do you do on a day-to-day basis?
Yeah, I like that question, actually. I don't think anybody really cares what someone in my shoes does, but I think like a CEO, like, depends on where their skill set is. They have to be really good at everything. I think it depends on where their skill set is. You can see that that's usually the strongest part of the company. I do spend a lot of time in every aspect of the business. I spend the most of my time in the area of the business that needs the most help at that given period of time. So if we're not doing well in marketing, I'm spending about 70% of my time in marketing. And it's almost like, it's inevitably like a balloon. So I squeeze on marketing and marketing starts to get doing really well. And then product development sucks. And I start working on product development and then our supply logistics suck. Then I start working on that and then like finance starts breaking. I start working on that and there's an inevitable HR problem. So, you know, I try to spend equal amount of time across the business. So I just got out of our weekly marketing meeting. So weekly marketing, you know, tomorrow will be finance, success marketing Wednesday, operations on Wednesday, product on Thursday, and then a week wrap up on Friday, and rinse and repeat every week. So I'm in each one of those meetings every week.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, are you still enjoying it?
I love it. It's a great challenge. I love getting up every day and trying to kick ass every day.
A lot of subscription revenue, 20 million top line. Business must be worth a lot. What's the future hold for you? Are you gonna sell it at some point?
Yeah, that's a good question. Which one of those two do you want me to take? Worth a lot or sell it at some point?
I mean, it's obviously worth a lot. You don't need to answer that one.
Well, yeah, I mean, but I think there's an interesting conversation to be had there because, and I don't know, I mean, the short answer on number two is it's not a legacy business, I do think. So my children probably are not going to inherit this business from me. So I think, yeah, at some point, somebody who's more capable than me will take it further. So I would like to see that, right? I would like someone more capable of me that has skill sets beyond the skill sets that I have to take it to a certain revenue, will take it further. And that is my wish. The concept of, is it worth a lot? I just want to talk about that, not specific, like 100%, you know, with regards to my company, but there's so many things, you know, there's so many things that, go into, you know, the value of a company. It's so incredibly difficult. And it changes just like the real estate market changes, right? The real estate market in the US is really slow right now. Interest rates are high. You know, there's a lot of taxation going on. Property taxes are going up in a lot of cities. Supply of housing is down because no one's investing in building new homes because they're hard to sell. So, you know, it's really hard. I think in the last several years, I was thinking about raising money in 2021. We've never raised money. We've only grown organically through what, you know, like a normal company. We make profit and invest it. But I think it's like, it's really, really hard to say. It has a lot to do with how quickly you're growing and whether or not you're making money and whether or not a valuation is on revenue or on, you know, or on profit or on some combination of a revenue multiplier based on your growth rate and considering your profit. So I think, and then I think what is going on in the market at any given time. So until interest rates, I think, come back down and there's a lot more capital, investment capital available where people are trying to deploy their capital into buying companies that, you know, can continue to grow for them. I think, you know, the market's a little tight right now. So who knows, you know, it could be, what could be worth $1, you know, a specific dollar amount today, and 3 years it could be, you know, worth three times that, or vice versa. So,
yeah.
You know, hopefully I'm just at the right place at the right time.
Mm. Yeah, and it's a good place to be in, I think, because if your answer was, oh, yeah, you know, I really want to get to X amount of dollars and then retire and not work so much, all of the emotion behind that is dependent. You're reliant so much on the timing of the market, whereas it seems like you just want to keep building, and then when the time is right and it all feels good, then you can do that. And
yeah, I mean, that is the idea. You know, the idea is, this is cliche, but this is the only way, is to build a really good company. And if you build a really good company, you know, that's all you can do is hope that you do a really good job. You build a sustainable company that continue to grow. And, you know, if the time is right, at some point you get off the school bus.
Mm. Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. No, this has been really, really insightful. I could ask you questions all day. I'm trying to resist, you know, keeping on poking the bear and asking more questions, because we'll go all day otherwise. But is there anything like just big that I've missed you feel would be worth mentioning and finishing up with?
You know, I mean, we're in the holiday season, and, you know, pretty much everybody is really looking, you know, is looking into the next, you know, six weeks. Mm. As being kind of a very important driver for business. It's never really actually been that critical of a time, but we've done a lot better over the last several years of making it more important. And so we're really looking to finish the year strong. And I think almost every DTC company in the world is thinking about that. And then, you know, I'm thinking about what the macro looks like and macro environment for our business. And 2024, you know, U.S. has got a very big election coming up, and its election creates a lot of anxiety in the market. So really looking to see how long interest rates, you know, continue to remain high, and how, you know, crazy things get with this election. They're already appearing to be very crazy because of all the people involved. So, you know, really trying to figure out and hunker down. They said that 2023, people were prognosticating that it was going to be a very difficult year with the economy. I think it proved out to be a better year than I expected. Mm. So, and I'm just very apprehensive about uncertainty of 2024, given that we're still in a very negative cycle of high inflation. High prices, and so we'll see what 2024 looks. I'm really interested to talk, you know, to know more and think more about that.
Yeah, it's going to be interesting, definitely. But as you say, I think it's been more positive than a lot of us expected it to be, so fingers crossed.
Agree.
Amazing. Where can people find out more about you, about the brand?
Yeah, just follow me on LinkedIn. I publish a lot of content there, and I respond to a lot of people who ask questions to me on LinkedIn, and you know, that's the channel I'm the most active on. Follow us on and all of our socials on for Teige, T-I-E-G-E, Teige.com, and follow us on you know, on our socials and on LinkedIn, if you will.
Yeah, definitely. The Teige.com, that's an awesome domain. Like, did you start with that?
Yes. Yeah. I bought that years and years before I bought the business. I had Teige Hanley's a family name, so I really liked the name, and I thought there's other phenomenal names of products out there, you know. So I figured we could create a brand around Teige Hanley, and I bought the five letter URL, you know, way early on.
That's
crazy.
Yeah, that. Very rare to see a five-letter domain.
Yep.
So that's an asset in itself.
Yeah, it's pretty great.
Amazing. Kelly, thanks so much for taking the time out. I've really enjoyed this conversation. It's been super inspiring, insightful, and I'm sure our audience have got a lot out of it. So thanks for taking the time.
Thanks, sir. Appreciate it. Have a good day.
Awesome, folks. Well, thank you for joining us on this episode. I'm sure you got a lot of value out of that as well. If you did, be sure to check out the resources of Tej and Kelly. Check all their stuff out. We'll leave that in the description. And we'll see you in the same episode, same time next week for a new episode. Take care. Bye-bye.